This episode is brought to you in part by Richmond Graduate University. The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly. Richmond Graduate University can equip you to become a licensed professional counselor, integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmond.edu.
In recent weeks, we've entered a world without professional sports and with millions of people forced to remain in their homes. In other words, we're in a time ripe for a weird Netflix show to become a cultural artifact. Enter Tiger King. The 7-part series showcases the bizarre world of the Americans who own big cats. In recent weeks, we've recorded some serious episodes and published dozens of thoughtful essays. Last week, you might have heard our episode that we did about live streaming, and we mentioned that we'll also have a discussion about churches that have more issues reaching some of their less digitally connected members, and that is still on the pipeline, and we will still make that happen. We decided to go with a bit more levity and discuss big cats with someone who studies them. You're listening to Quick to Listen, where we go beyond hashtags and hot takes to discuss a major cultural event. I'm Morgan Lee, digital media producer here at Christianity Today.
And I am Ted Olson, editorial director at Christianity Today. Morgan, are you back in the office today? Are you in our professional studio? Are you a... what do they call it? Essential worker to run the studio? Or are you doing this from home?
I am in the recording bunker. Nice. Hanging out here at the office. Ted, let us chime in on the national conversation that we are having that has nothing to do with coronavirus and instead has to do with people who own tigers and lions and so forth.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I mean, it is a show about people who own big cats, but it is also this kind of, those who haven't seen it, it's like this murder mystery or, you know, like, oh, well, it's a true crime, not murder mystery, true crime show, you know, in the world of big cat owners. And it's one of these strange multi-part documentaries that kind of catches people's imaginations. Is this our gut check, Morgan?
This is. I would love to hear what you think so far.
Well, so, I'm super interested because, so the whole idea here is that there's this guy with a bunch of big cats who...
Joe Exotic,
who then, you know, is involved in this kind of murder for hire with his main kind of critic slash rival. But when I first heard about it, I thought it was a totally different story about a guy who owned a bunch of big cats who had tried to kill a rival. And that's another story that happened right here in our backyard by the Christian Today offices, a town called Batavia. Not Tiger King Joe Exotic, but a guy called Lauren Womack, who's currently serving a long prison sentence for like almost exactly the same story that is being documented in this Netflix series, where he had tried to hire hitman to kill a romantic rival and is alleged to have to have killed somebody else. So I'm like, what is going on with these big cat owners? My attraction to this story is very different. You may know this, Morgan, some other people may know this, that I am a big, you know, animal lover is a silly word, but I am definitely drawn to large mammals. My Facebook photo, ever since kind of Facebook became open to non-university students, has been this image of me at the Brookfield Zoo with the lion that was there at the time, looking through the glass at each other. I had this magazine at Christianity Today for a while called The Behemoth, where the whole point of that had kind of was about awe and wonder. You know, kind of the memory of it is that it was a science magazine, but it wasn't really a science magazine. It was this magazine about awe and wonder. And part of that comes from the awe and wonder that I experienced with animals. I find animals just so, they take me out of where I am and remind me that there are big things out there. There are really interesting things that are really unlike me, and I don't know everything. There is nothing more awe-inspiring for me than to look very closely at a lion's giant eyes. It's hard to come up with. I'm a professional word guy, but the words for the feeling that you have in that moment are hard to articulate. It's scary and joyful at the same time. Awe is probably the best word for it. I am interested in the people who are interested in that, but I'm mostly interested in the animals themselves. So that's my gut check and why when Morgan, when you said, can we talk about Tiger King this week instead of coronavirus? I said, yeah, of things that can kill you, I'm much more interested in talking about big cats than small viruses. So let's take a break and talk about something completely different in nature that could destroy us without warning.
Ted,
what's your gut check?
Well, my gut check is, first of all, I think you know that I got to meet some tigers recently.
Yes.
I'll be honest, Ted, I didn't realize that I was like stepping into this larger industry when I was there. Especially
where was
one
it,
that had. Sorry?
You should say where it was, for one thing.
I was outside of Chiang Mai in Thailand there at a place called Tiger Kingdom. And there are two different Tiger Kingdoms that are in Thailand. And I personally thought that it was something unique to Thailand. I will say, after listening to this episode yesterday, one of the people on there, his name is Doc something or other. He talks about how it's like several hundred dollars or maybe like more than $500 for this. Made me think I should have paid to meet the tiger cubs when I was there. I paid to meet two different sizes of tiger because that's how they price them out there. But I did not pay for the baby cubs, though I did take really great video of them. And they really are as precious as you think that they are. Yeah, it was fascinating meeting them. I kind of wanted to do that because I did not actually think that that was something that you could do in the U.S. I had never really known that there was people who had exotic animal sanctuaries, farms. I don't know what you want to call them here in the U.S. I do like animals, though probably not as much as you do, Ted. But I remember growing up and watching shows like Kratz Creatures very religiously and being very into it then. I'm happy that we get to talk about this today because I know you get really excited about it, which makes me very excited about it too.
Kratz Creatures. This is where I do feel more generation gapped with you, Morgan. I hate to step fully into the Mark Galley mode here. Kratz Creatures is truly a great show. I'm not quite old enough to be of the Jack Hanna, but yes, I associate Kratz Creatures and Zaboomafoo and all those kinds of animal PBS shows. I'm kind of in the middle, in the gap. We didn't really have a Gen X animal show. We had, I guess, Animal Planet kind of came out around that time. But yep, that's good stuff. We should get to our guest. Oh, wait, but before we do, this is a podcast, Morgan. And we should share that the Netflix show Tiger King is not the only game in town. People who are podcast nuts may also be interested in a new podcast called Cat People, put out by folks at Long Reads. I've dipped into that. It's about the same exact story.
But
if you'd rather get your interesting true crime big cat fix over there, if you'd rather get that by audio rather than a Netflix video, you have your choice these days. Both of these are running simultaneously. We're going to talk less about murder for hire plots and more about big mammals. So that's what I'm excited about.
Yes. Tell us who our guest is, Ted.
Our guest today is Dr. Mike Mooring, who is professor of biology at Point Loma Nazarene University. I am so excited that he has done field studies of African antelope, bison here in North America, neotropical mammals in Costa Rica. He's doing some amazing stuff. Thanks, Mike. And you were telling us in the lead up to the show that this is not your lifelong passion. This is your third career.
Yeah. Hi. Well, thank you for having me on your podcast, as I told my family. I'm misspeaking. My son said, "Dad, it'll be a disaster." So with that encouragement,
wow.
I thought I would, I would just go forward and take a leap of faith and, walk in to the lion's den. But yeah, no, what I do is...
He's been on for 30 seconds and he's made two animal puns. And so I'm already loving this podcast.
Yeah. So, what I do now, I've been teaching at this small Christian liberal arts university in San Diego, in view of the ocean, by the way.
It's beautiful. I've been to the campus.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's 22 years now, but this is not the first thing I was planning to do. When I was younger, back in the 70s, I worked in social justice movement with Cesar Chavez and Farm Workers Union. And then I went on to study musical theater and drama in New York City. And then I somehow ended up in Colorado, I guess, because of all the mountains, the Rocky Mountains and nature and so forth, going towards for wildlife biology, really. This is interesting how God leads us along various twists and turns and brings us to places we would never expect to be. And
Well, it's great to have you here, Mike. I am wondering if we can just start this interview by you telling us about the first big cat that you saw up close and personal.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting question because, you know, I must give the disclaimer that I'm not really a very good foil to Joe Exotic. I mean, I don't really get into, you know, small enclosures with large cats and, you know, I am down and shoot my pistol and snap my whip. But I know I do. Actually, I grew up in New York City. I remember very well going to the Central Park Zoo. My mom would take us to the Central Park Zoo, which is a tiny zoo. You know, when you're a kid, it seemed much bigger, of course. It's only 7 acres. We loved it, you know, because it was something different from giant water bugs and big gray squirrels and pigeons and, you know, the normal wild urban wildlife that we were accustomed to. And I distinctly remember going into, I'm not sure what they called it, the big cat block, which was basically a cement bunker with lots of bars, you know. So this is the old school zoo version of this is how you got dangerous animals, you stick them behind bars, and, you know, to make it easy to clean up, everything's cement. So really, it was like in retrospect, it was awful, you know. But as a kid, I just remember going in to that big room, there'd be lots of people, and it would just stink, you know. It was just this very pungent odor of big cat, and they'd have the lions and whatever other cats they had there. I don't really remember. So that was my first up close and personal encounter with, because you were right there, you know. I mean, they didn't have to separate you with moats and all the things they do now with naturalistic enclosures. I mean, you were just right there in that little building. I have since that time done my dissertation work I did in Southern Africa. So I was there for, and then my postdoc in Southern Africa. So I was in Zimbabwe and South Africa and Namibia, had a trip to Kenya. So I've seen, you know, lions and cheetahs and leopards, and I haven't seen tigers because they're not found in Africa, but all those African cats, you know, have had an opportunity to see a few in the States in some of the places I've worked. I got to tell you though, that honestly, in Costa Rica, we've been doing this work for 10 years, and, you know, they're elusive. There's a reason why they're known as elusive mammals. You just don't see them. You know, they're either nocturnal or they're hiding. And so the way we actually do our research is we put up these, what they call camera traps. They're basically automatic cameras. You stick them on trails and so forth, and got an infrared sensor, and they take a picture or possibly a video when the animal passes by. Kind of indirectly, though, we've seen a lot of cats in our cameras from jaguar, which is the third largest big cat after tigers and African lions, and the largest in the New World, all the way down to a kind of a house cat size spotted cat known as the oncia. And we get 6 species in Costa Rica. So that really is where I really started to work on a professional level with some cats, including a big cat, which is very charismatic. You know, I mean, all I can say is that, you know, as I had opportunity to work in the wild, I just, you know, because my testimony is that I was really drawn to God through nature, not the other way around. I saw God in nature, and I came to Christ in Zimbabwe, and I got married in Zimbabwe. Everything happened there because that's where I really felt the Lord speak to me, and through his creation and through these animals.
Tell us a little bit more about that. This was while you were doing some of your doctoral work? Was this postdoctoral? And
correct.
Did,
yeah. No.
How did you find God as you were researching? Yeah. Was it Impala that you were researching at the time? Is that right?
That is, well, yes. So I actually started out with herbivores. So not at all a big cat carnivore guy. Some of my colleagues would describe my study animals as cat food because, you know, that's what they eat, you know. And impala, yeah. So impala are a great animal. They're very common. They're medium-sized antelope. And I was studying them because they have a very interesting behavior insofar as they groom themselves and one another, and they do it to remove ticks. And so I was actually studying tick removal behavior, and that actually ended up being a kind of an ongoing project. And then from there, I studied bison and elk and deer and moose, had a long-term study in Nebraska with bison. And then that ended, and it ended pretty suddenly. You know, it was like 1 year we were there over the summer, and they said, well, this is the last summer. Gosh, you know, what am I going to do next? And we had just started a course that went down to Costa Rica. In May, we went down to Costa Rica with this course, had a fantastic experience with our students, came back, went to Nebraska for a study. This is it for the study. This summer is the last, and started to think, wow, is there anything we can do in Costa Rica? And so we started talking with colleagues and the idea of, well, we could put up some trail cameras. No one's done a study of mammals in this area before. Maybe that is something we could do. So it literally started like that.
That's amazing. Was it tricky to go from the herbivore? Well, I guess, I mean, there's probably some herbivores who would be in your elusive mammal category, right? Would tapirs, I assume, would be in that group?
Yeah. And in fact, tapirs are kind of a big player, literally a big player. And those that are not familiar with tapirs are related to rhinos and horses, and they are the largest animal in South America. The big guys can reach 600 pounds. I mean, they're just huge. But we get a lot of them in our cameras, actually.
So I'm curious about, for you, like, are you still having these moments where your breath is taken away by an encounter with nature? Do you become more blasé about it, or where do those moments of joy and awe come for you now that you've been years and years into this?
I call myself like an enthusiastic amateur birder. I don't keep life lists and that kind of thing. I kind of know what I've seen, but I kind of forget what I've seen too. So it's cool because I see a beautiful bird and it's like, oh, what's that? Oh yeah, I've seen that one before. Yeah. I think in the safari industry, they call people that are just trying to check things off the list, they call them checkers, and they just going along. Okay. We want to see the big five. Okay. We've got the lion. Okay. We've got the elephant. Okay. We've got the rhino. Okay. Check off the list. That's really not me. I mean, I remember my wife and I going for a safari drive in Zimbabwe, and there really weren't any large animals out at all. And we ended up investigating dung beetles. And it was fascinating. It was fun. We just stopped, and there was some ele poop on the ground, and it's like dung beetles, and this is cool. I think that there is a joy, like you say, an awe and wonder in wild animals just doing their thing and having the opportunity to kind of take a peek at what they're doing.
I do want to bring this conversation back to the big cats because I'm personally curious about them. And I'm curious, obviously, you've studied lots of different types of mammals. What really makes a big cat unique or special compared to other mammals?
They are big cats, as all cats. All cats are really interesting because if you look at the world of the carnivores, most carnivores eat something besides meat. They'll eat some fruit, or they'll eat some vegetation, or they'll be more opportunistic. For example, dogs. What do we feed dogs? We don't usually just feed them entirely meat. They get a lot of kibbles, which have grains and so forth in them, but isn't necessarily the best diet for them. But cats, they eat meat. They are meat eaters. They are obligate meat eaters. That's all they eat. And if you take a look at the inside of a cat's mouth, which you want to be careful about doing when you're talking about the big cats, you can see all their teeth are meat-eating teeth. They've got the canines and the incisors and the premolars. And, they're just completely, and they've got huge jaws, and their whole skull morphology is designed to take a chomp out of another animal. And that's also true of their hunting strategy. Cats are primarily ambush predators. There are exceptions, of course. Cheetah are probably the biggest exception because they are ambush predators that then run really fast to get their prey. And lions are kind of ambush predators, but they work in groups, cooperative hunters. Most of the other, there's 41 species of cats in the world, of which three are considered the big cats, tigers, and I guess five are in the Panthera genus. So that would be tigers is the big one, the biggest, African lions, the second, jaguars, third, and then leopard, and then snow leopard. There's 41 smaller species as well. And they all are entirely meat eaters. They're ambush predators. They tend to have a solitary lifestyle. So that really makes them different from a lot of the animals that we think about that live in groups. Again, lions being the big exception to that.
I was wondering too, if you could speak about maybe like what makes them unique from like an intelligence point of view too.
So, I think we have to be careful when we talk about animal intelligence because their intelligence is based on what they need to do to be successful in life. the kind of things that we would think of as, you know, indicating intelligence, kind of abstract kinds of calculations and being able to remember and predict into the future and so forth. They have that, of course, superbly honed, but to accomplish their purpose, which is basically to, you know, to catch their prey, to be successful in defending their territory, which may be very large, and in mating and reproducing. So, you know, their intelligence is, we would say they probably are. So think of the difference between a dog and a cat. If you think about a dog, you think about, oh, you know, dogs are really intelligent. We can teach them tricks, right? Have you ever tried to teach a cat a trick? And we would, I mean, you could say, oh, those cats, they're just stupid. They can't, you know, you can't teach them a trick. Well, you know, there's a reason for that is because dogs have a social intelligence that cats don't have because they're not social. So basically their social intelligence is get away from me.
Yeah.
Get away from me or kill you. Whereas, as you know, of course, canids in general and dogs specifically are brilliant at that social interaction, as are primates, you know, which is why we're so social as well. So, you know, it's a different kind of intelligence, but they certainly have that unique intelligence. And it's also kind of, I think, part of the allure, you know, why are people attracted to big cats, you know? And I think that from time immemorial, people have had this both primeval fear coupled with fascination with the big cats because they're mysterious. You know, they come and go. You don't know where they are. They're elusive. They kind of pop out of the night and then they disappear. We know they're extremely powerful. Tigers and lions and jaguars, extremely powerful. You know, there's all that kind of mixed into what attracts us and what makes them special, kind of draws us to try to understand them better. And the fact is, for most of these, certainly the big cats have been better studied than many of the other cats, but we just don't know a lot about a lot of these species because they're elusive. We can't just follow them around in a Land Rover on the African savanna. They just slink into the woods and they're gone. So it's really been through a lot of new technology, radio tracking, satellite collars, and camera traps and so forth that we're actually finally beginning to learn a little bit more about them.
Is there, besides size, I mean, are there significant differences between like the big cats and some of the smaller cats, especially, you know, I'm thinking in Costa Rica where you are, you mentioned one of the smaller cats, but there's, you know, a number of smaller cat species. Are there behavior or what separate, I don't even know, what separates a big cat from a...
Sure. So, I mean, the classic definition of what makes a big cat, meaning a Panthera cat, Panthera tigris, Panthera leo, and Panthera onca are the three big cats, tiger, lion, jaguar. And it's their ability to roar. They have this, it's sort of the hyoid apparatus, which is part of their vocal apparatus, enables them to roar. So your kitty at home is not going to be able to roar. It can purr, right? Cats can purr, and a jaguar can purr. And you would certainly want them to probably prefer them to purr than to roar.
Let's do some gene splicing. Terrify people.
But yeah. So panthers can purr but not roar is what you're saying, right?
Correct. So yeah. The roaring is
they're unique. Big, but they're not big cats.
Yeah, they're big, but they're not in that big cat category that can roar.
Fascinating. So is that it? I mean, in terms of the idea, but there's not a lot of behavioral differences between the roaring cats and the...
Again, big difference, a big kind of unique thing in the big cat world is the difference between lions and most of these other cats because they're so social. And of course, because they are found in large prides, they don't really have fear of people or anything else. And so it's fairly easy to observe them. And so lots of studies have been done on them. Not so many studies done on jaguar because we just don't ever see them unless by chance or it's to kill your cow or something like that, in which case most people, ranchers' response is to try to kill the jaguar. So in terms of behavior, what you're talking about is a solitary animal, males or females, roaming around very large ranges. You know, we're just starting, including in our research, but other people's as well, trying to find out about when they're active, their activity cycles. And we can do that with the cameras because the cameras have a time and a date stamp on it. So we know when they're active, at least in front of the cameras. We assume that they're active when they're not in front of the cameras. Many of them are nocturnal. Jaguar are actually a lot more diurnal than we previously thought. But they're roaming around. They are, you know, they're resting. when they need to rest. They're looking for prey. And from time to time, the females come into condition and, you know, through their scent, they attract males, the male mates. From all that we know, you know, based on captive breeding, it's a pretty spectacular, you know, lively interaction because they're solitary animals and they basically don't want the other to get close, but they have to because that's how they're going to reproduce. And then they part ways and the female has her kittens or cubs. And so the only time you'll see an adult with other individuals in terms of a big cat is when she's with her, you know, one or in the case of jaguar, one or two kittens, and until they are, you know, independent at about a year or so. So that's something that we're just starting to find out. And it's actually really pretty rare to catch the kittens or the cubs on the cameras. So usually we just see the solitary animal.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
What I loved most of all about Israel and why I became a Zionist was because Zionism was a rejection of victimhood.
A few weeks ago on CT's The Bulletin, we launched Promised Land, a new podcast about Israel and Palestine in a post-October 7th world.
6:30 a.m., we're in our synagogue praying, and sirens go off, and they're going on. And on.
Based on interviews and conversations captured on the ground in Israel last November, it's an exploration of the spiritual, political, and historical roots of the conflict.
When there's a weak Israel, every Jew in the world is weak.
And why should a Russian Jew who has nothing to do with this land come here? Why? Well, I mean, if you want, you can give them Texas. You love them so much.
I am alive because I didn't come home. But all my friends that were here were murdered. Here, over there.
This week, Promised Land moves to its own feed. You'll find links in the show notes. So if you haven't heard it yet, you can go catch up and catch the new episodes as they come all in one place.
When I've been watching this show, right, you see a lot of humans horsing around with these animals. And I know that not all animals are able to domesticate. But I'm just curious, like, what am I supposed to make of these people on the show that say they have these very close relationships with these animals? And of course, it's all predicated on the belief that they're also very dangerous, right? And not really able to be tamed.
Obviously, it takes a little bit of, shall we say, showmanship or show-offship, you know, to go into that situation with an animal that's quite dangerous and just horse around with it. There are people who do this professionally as trainers, you know, for example, for animals that are used in movies, and they do have a relationship. They do have a very, I would say, strong relationship with that animal because they have to be able to control that animal. If they can't control the animal, that would be disaster. You know, that really takes a lot of knowledge of animal behavior. I mean, I can't really speak for how much knowledge of animal behavior Joe Exotic has. He obviously has had to have enough understanding of the behavior of those tigers to be able to survive. And so, I mean, I would respect that. My take on this is that in the vast majority of those cases that you're talking about, it's not that the cat just loves the trainer or the Joe Exotic or whoever, but it's because they've learned through a conditioning process of punishment and reward that they better act this way or it's going to go badly for them. It's a learning process. And that's kind of what taming is. You know, think about people say, oh, it's a tame kitty. It's a tame, you know, tiger. Well, you know, no, it's not. It may be tame, which means it's learned to behave itself because of, you know, conditioning, which is basically learning how to avoid aversive behavior and how to do behaviors that will elicit a reward. It's still a wild animal, by the way. They still have a very strong predatory instinct. I think that what you always have to keep in mind is that they may look like they're just playing and having a, you know, a jolly good time, but that trainer or whatever has got to really know what they're doing and really control the situation, because it is a wild animal that's totally capable of completely destroying that person if things get out of hand. So don't do this at home is the message, you know.
Right. So I'm curious about how, you know, as someone who studies this stuff, like, and you mentioned that your study of animals kind of led you, or being at least in nature, kind of led you to understand or seek out who God is more. Interested in hearing a little bit more about that. And just also how do you view right now your relationship between, or the relationship between these animals that are out there in the earth and us humans who are also out there in the earth?
My personal experience, I think, has just been, I mean, look, I grew up in New York City. So, I mean, I'm not going to make a claim that I grew up in harmony with nature, you know, nature boy. And I, you know, I just always wanted to be in harmony with these animals. I mean, I grew up in Washington Heights in New York City. And again, the wildlife was the squirrels and pigeons. That was a megafauna. And then the cockroaches inside. As I had opportunity, because we would go out to, so this is a little bit of biography, but my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, would go up to New Hampshire every summer. He was actually a pastor in Jamestown, New York, and then he would kind of switch churches and preach at a church in Hillsborough in New Hampshire. And so we'd go to New Hampshire in the summer. And of course, for a kid that grows up in the inner city, to go to New Hampshire was like, oh, this is like paradise, you know, and we would stay either on a lake or at a big old kind of colonial farmhouse. There's a picture, and I actually remember this. There was a gate when we first started coming there, and I climbed up on the gate. On the other side of the gate were all these cattle, and I just kind of, you know, looking at this big old cow, and there's a picture of me. And, you know, that really was my first, along with the big cat block in the Central Park Zoo, you know, my first encounter with animals. And then as I had opportunity to go hiking and to spend time in the bush and in the wild, various opportunities as I grew up, and I would see animals, you know, that were wild. And the awe and wonder that you mentioned before, Ted, I think that's part of that whole thing. It's like, wow, that's really cool, you know? I mean, I can't, It's kind of hard to describe, you know, just been something that's been very pleasing and very fulfilling to just be able to see kind of nature and see wild animals in their element, which is something that sadly a lot of folks growing up don't see, because we're an increasingly urbanized society. You know, over 50% of the world population lives in a city, and most of them aren't going to see that. One more thing to add to that is that for most of the time I've been doing animal behavior research, my research has been largely non-invasive, meaning that it's been mostly behavioral observation. So, you know, I'm sitting on a bluff overlooking a meadow, or maybe in a vehicle looking at bison or whatever. Maybe I have a telescope that I'm using, whatever, but I'm basically observing. And these observations go on for hours, right? So spending hours and hours of every day just watching animals do what they do. And most of the time, by the way, animals don't do a whole lot of exciting things. They're not, if you're watching lions, you know, what do? 22 hours of the day, they sleep, right? Not terribly exciting. Any animal that you watch, most of the time, they're eating. They're certainly herbivores or grazing. They're moving around. They're resting. They're not doing a whole lot, you know. But, and it takes a special kind of person to be able to do that and not get totally bored. And I would say I really never got bored. I just liked you know, this is kind of harks to Peter Sellers' last movie, but, you know, being there, being there with the animals, feeling like I could kind of in some way join their world. There's a lot.
Mike, I'm curious about, how would you say that your research or your animal behavior research has changed how you understood God, how God has made you to be?
One of the things that I think that you have to come away with at some point is that my perspective on life is very limited. You know, all of ours, right? You know, we got our plans. We've got the things that we want to do. We've got our to-do lists, got our aspirations and so forth. But they're actually kind of small compared with the big picture. And there's lots of ways to see a big picture, right? For me, I think seeing that big picture was seeing kind of the big picture of the creation of nature, of these animals and plants and trees, and just this massive tableau, if you will, of life. I'm just like, a speck in that. I'm like a fly on the wall, just observing those things. And so kind of in that sense, now that's one aspect. That's the aspect that, you know what, you know, God's doing something bigger than just trying to meet my aspirations and make me happy and so forth. There's something bigger there. But also there's this aspect of that, you know, if I can just be there and be a part of this thing that God is doing, that's enough. That's more than enough. That's very fulfilling. When I first became a Christian, I was kind of a little bit nervous, a little bit scared that God would ask me to do something that I didn't want to do, like go to an urban area, go away from the bush and go away from nature. And in fact, you know, that's what I do. I'm in an urban area. I teach at, you know, San Diego at a college, but I came to realize that, you know, the greatest joy is being able to fulfill God's purpose for your life, whatever that is. And the thing is, we probably, at least I have precious little understanding of what that is when you start out. I think the key is just kind of being open to what doors God opens and trying to see if that's where he wants you to go, you know.
I'm curious if in your, so you started off, you know, looking at these Impala, looking at, you know, looking at these things, moving towards highly predatory animals. You know, to me, there is this awe that comes with a powerful predator, that there's an awe and a terror that, you know, the brokenness, I guess, is the question that I often bump up against. Like in my own, when I look at my own self and like, what can I learn about God through other people? Like I keep bumping up against the kind of brokenness of the world, my own sinfulness, a lot of those kinds of things. When I see, you know, large predators, part of it is less that I see the brokenness of the world and more, I guess I understand a little bit of that, the fear of God in some ways, not necessarily like, but I can see why some of these animals were, you know, idolized in various and sundry ways over the years, that there is this thing bigger than myself that can destroy me, that kind of stops, that I kind of understand that fear of God that is not like a, well, I guess, you know, there's a reason C.S. Lewis chose, this is, you know, the thing we've been avoiding. There's a reason C.S. Lewis chose a lion for Aslan, right? There's a reason he got this kind of Lion of Judah idea, that there is this kind of fear, joy, awe, and not a fear that you want to run away from, but a fear that you want to get closer to with some of these big cats. I wonder, you know, because my experience has been mostly with, you know, the lions, because they're a little bit easier to see, and I spent some time in Kenya. I wonder if the elusiveness of some of these cats and trying to suss out what are these animals like is somewhat a little bit like trying to, the elusiveness of God. He's very approachable, but yet he is very mysterious in this way too. I was reflecting on. I wonder if there's anything along those lines for you.
Those are observations that I can definitely identify with. Yeah, and I think that's what when I went to Zimbabwe as a PhD student, I was, you know, agnostic, and I wasn't looking for God, and certainly wasn't looking to become a evangelical Christian or anything like that. And that just happened. It happened through just realizing that there was a bigger picture than just me, that when I didn't know whether to call that God or nature or something else, but came to realize through other people the proper names and that this is the God of the universe. But there's also, I think, this sense. So one of the things that is interesting about, and I'm not sure folks always understand this, about doing conservation work, which is what I do. Basically, all the survey work that we do is, it's got a very applied purpose in so far as trying to know what kind of animals we have in these mountains so that we can better protect them. But you can't do conservation without people. And I'm going to swing back to God here, but you can't do conservation without people. You can know all about every jaguar in the forest and not be able to save them because, for whatever reason, people don't value them and they're not protected or a habitat is lost or what have you. Just doing research is not enough. It'll never be enough. Conservation, which in my world is how I see caring for creation, caring for God's creation, is conservation of his creatures and his ecosystems. That always involves people. So you don't ever exclude people. People always, and so the work that we do is community-based conservation. We work with local communities. Actually, people in the local communities are actually running our camera surveys for the most part, because we're not there year-round. You've got to teach, got to do my job. We give them equipment and training and empower them to be able to do that research. And then they do it. And then they're in that community. And we sometimes come and go to community meetings and so forth. But then we share that with the community people to try to instill a sense of, you've got some incredible creatures, you know, maybe let's protect them better, and kind of instill that sense of stewardship. That reaching out to other people is something that I think is a unique ability that these animals have. People who maybe would never work with us if we said, hey, we're a bunch of Christians and we want to study some animals, are absolutely delighted to work with us because we are going to help them conserve the animals that they really care about. And we're just really fortunate that in Costa Rica, there's kind of a conservation ethic kind of ingrained in most people now. I mean, people really value that aspect of their country, that there is such an emphasis on conservation and sustainability and caring for their natural environment. The point here is that, if I could say it this way, that these animals can act as a bridge to sharing God with people and sharing, in some sense, our relationship with people. I mean, I always pray that, you know, in some way, God would shine his light on the people that we work with. We don't select people who, you know, kind of fit our criteria. We work with people who want to work with us, and whoever they are and whatever they believe. And most people in Costa Rica are nominal Christians, but that doesn't mean they have a relationship. I think that that's another way of showing that, look, if we love the creation, that speaks of a love for the creator. I think that the two go together. They're kind of this organic whole that can really speak into the lives of people that we care about, and we want them to know God better.
Awesome. Also, that reminds me of an article we recently ran in CT. Maybe we could get in the show notes from about a year ago on God loving protective species and the poachers who kill them and the relationship in both.
That article was so good. We'll definitely link to it. Mike, just to wrap our conversation and put you on the spot for a little bit, is there a really good big cat story that you have where you spotted one or had an interaction with one that you would want our listeners to know?
Okay, this is the best story I can give you, being put on the spot on short notice. I kind of gave you a little bit of the backstory that in 2010, we were told, actually 2009, we were told that our bison research was going to wrap up. And so in 2010, I show up with my students in Costa Rica, and it's like, you know, this is an experiment. This is kind of like our pilot study is what we call it, meaning that we have no idea if this is going to work or not. We're just going to give it our best shot and see what happens, right? And so we show up in this high elevation mountain community, which is also an ecotourism center. There's a whole story behind that. The guy, it was uninhabited until the 50s, and the guy and his brother came in, homesteaded it, and then over time was convinced that he had to stop cutting down the forest and turn to ecotourism. We show up in this valley. We have 10 cameras, and we're just going to put up some cameras and see what happens. Right? The manager of the field station we worked at, which is called the Quetzal Education Research Center, it's run by Southern Nazarene University. David Hilly and his wife, Sarah, they set up a meeting for us when we first got there. So it's like, okay, I had to kind of try to retrieve my Spanish. It's all in Spanish. We talked about what we were going to do. And then and the idea was at the end of that period of time, we were going to give a wrap-up report. This is what we've discovered kind of thing. And we were there for about 8 weeks, I want to say. Well, as the weeks went on, we got lots and lots and lots of pictures of raccoons. And we kind of realized that probably wasn't going to make a very exciting wrap-up meeting with the community. You know, it's like raccoons. Yeah, is that all you got? And so, getting a little bit desperate here. And so it's we're literally down to the wire. It's like a couple days before the community meeting, the whole community is going to come and we're going to give our report. We've got, you know, lots of pictures of raccoons. And then we get this picture from one of our cameras. It's actually one of the cameras that was located a little bit higher up on the mountain. And by the way, this is right below the third highest mountain in Costa Rica called Cerro de la Muerte, Mountain of Death. We get this picture of this puma coming at the camera. It's a beautiful picture. Still looking at it. It's a lovely picture. Say, yes, we've got this picture. Okay, now we can, you know, now we can go forward and have something to show them. And so we prepared for our meeting and, you know, as we always do, my students and I had, you know, little things to say, try to give a little program, keep people entertained and so forth, and give them something to inspire them and benefit them. The morning, so this is going to be in the evening. So that morning, one of my students said, hey, well, you know, let's just check the cameras one more time. I said, okay, sure. So he goes out, he and his, the other student, Jared, so this is Caleb and Jared, they go out and they run the entire, in about an hour, they're back. You know, they run the entire camera transect. And they come back and we look at the pictures and the same camera where the puma was, we put in the chip, we look at it. There's this big black, what I initially thought was a big black dog. I said, like, oh man, got this dog on the trail, goodness sake. And then we look at it again, it's like, well, that ain't no dog. And we look at it again, it's like, that's a melanistic jaguar. And I sent it to a colleague at one of the universities, and he confirmed, yes, that's a jaguar. We actually showed it that evening, and it was electrifying, to say the least, because we're talking about they had never, ever seen pictures from the forest of the animals there to actually see a jaguar. You know, maybe a puma would have been good, right, and was good, but a jaguar, and not only a jaguar, but a black jaguar, a melanistic jaguar. In fact, people got so excited that people started leaping up, and this is how it works in Costa Rica. People started talking and had this whole conversation, a discussion going on, like, oh, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't have tourists on the trail. Maybe it's dangerous. Maybe we shouldn't go on the trail. What should we do? What should we do? You know, I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And then just by serendipity, the administrator of the national park that's closest to there was there and attending. I don't think he ever came after that, but that first time he came and he stood up and he said, you know, let me assure you, there's never been any report of jaguars attacking people. This is no problem at all. And everyone calmed down. Oh, good. Oh, we've got jaguar and we've got puma. And wow. Ever since that time, those community meetings are much anticipated, and we just love the relationship we have with the people there. And it's all because of that black jaguar that we got on that camera at the 11th hour on the last day before we were about to have our meeting and then take off. So,
well, thank
God
you
for
so
that.
Much for sharing that story. And I'm glad you got your shot. Maybe you can send us a picture of it and we can share it with people too, because I'm sure they'd like to see that.
I would be glad to.
All right. So if people have feedback for us, they can send us an email. We're at podcast@christianitytoday.com. We are also on Twitter at @ctpodcasts. Now is the time of the show we call Precious Moments. We ask everyone to share something that has brought them joy recently. Ted, you're up first.
Well, let's see. Last week I talked about preparing for my sermon, and that did, in fact, go well. So thanks for your prayers on that, Morgan, and anyone else. That was a precious moment, but I used up sermon prep last week. So, you know, I will just say playing board games with my family during this time of isolation has been... So my son and I played a great version of a great game of Scythe yesterday. The one we've been playing as a family, all four of us, is a game called Machi Koro Legacy, where you are building these Japanese towns. Well, you know, I don't know if they're Japanese towns, but there's a kind of a kawaii type art on this thing. It's nice is that each game builds upon the next game. That's what the legacy game means, is you kind of play through a series of, I guess, probably 10 games or so, and each game changes each to the rest. And that's been great. That's been something that all four of us have really enjoyed between Mario Kart tournaments here at the Olsen home. Trying to make the most of this isolation time. This is spring break week, so without homework to occupy the kids, we're having to get a little bit more creative. But we're having a good time over here.
People can find you on Twitter at Ted Olson.
They can find me on Twitter at Ted Olson if they wish.
And sometimes you'll post about animals and live cams that you like watching.
Oh, you know what? You know, Ted Olson's list of animal live cams, the best big cat cam. There are a number of captivity big cat live cams, which I don't really look at. Safari Live, which I've recommended in the past, is now rebranded as Wild Earth, and they have daily safaris that go out in South Africa. There are lions on occasion there. There are leopards. There are hyena. Any number of animals on there, and they're wild. They're not in captivity, and it's just like going on a safari. But
we'll link to that in the show notes.
It's great. So yeah, that should have been my precious moment. Thanks for letting me not end the podcast without all you listeners. All you listeners should know that I bore the heck out of my staff with wild cam or with live nature cam recommendations on a constant basis here. So now you all can put up with it as well.
My precious moment this week was last night. My roommate and her boyfriend and I had a campfire or fire. I don't know, had a fire in the fire pit. And that was the first one we've had in about 6 months. It was, to be honest, actually pretty bitter. It was pretty bittersweet in the sense of it felt very normal. And yet the larger world does not necessarily feel normal right now. And so that kind of juxtaposition was really intense in my mind. And it also made me so grateful that we have a backyard and a fire pit and the ability to enjoy things like that and not feeling just cooped up in my house right now.
And you did marshmallows?
No, it was just low key. No, it was a lot of just like really intense staring at the blue parts of the fire.
That is key.
But it was great. Mike, your turn.
South Africa has just gone into a lockdown mode where people aren't even allowed to leave their house. Now, my wife, Emma, she was born in Zambia, so she's a white African. She grew up in Zimbabwe, and her two sisters, one is in Spain now, one is in Cape Town area. And so Liza, the one in the Cape Town area, texted maybe a week ago saying that she had basically lost most of her income, and her husband had lost most of their income because of the shutdowns. They were going to have this lockdown, and she boards horses. I think she's got about 20 horses that she's boarding right now, and she didn't have enough feed for them. You know, and so we wanted to send them some money, and she said, no, don't send money. Just, you know, we'll just see what the Lord does. You know, just pray for us. And so he said, okay, we prayed, and we prayed, you know, Lord, just bring the food right to their door. And so so Liza is out. This is like a few hours before lockdown is going to begin. And they're not going to be able to leave at that point. She's running around trying to get last minute supplies, make sure they're as prepared as they can. And she gets back, and she goes into the stables, and she notices there's a little bit more hay there than she thought was there, but she thinks, oh, well, I guess that's how much there was. And then she comes back again. She realizes there is some more. There's like twice as much hay as I left with. And she gets starts to get really panicky because she thinks, well, it's a mistaken delivery. It's actually for one of my neighbors, and my neighbor's going to need it. So she starts frantically calling all the neighbors. Hey, is this yours? And if no, it's not mine. And finally, she calls someone, finds out it was actually one of her clients, and she's been teaching the daughter to ride she's kind of a horse whisperer, teaching the daughter to ride for the last 5 years. And she just, you know, she said, you know, I just felt the Lord say that you needed that feed. And so she had her husband drive all that feed and forage for the horses out there and drop it off. You know, the need was met, and it's just, you know, praise the Lord, you know, because how else were those horses going to get fed? So that was my precious, our precious moment to see how God faithfully answered that prayer, and as he always does in amazing ways. And I have a website. Is mostly research stuff with pictures, which is mikemoring.squarespace.com. There's a hyphen between Mike and Mooring, so mikemoring.squarespace.com. And I've also got stuff on my Point Loma Nazarene University webpage as well.
People can find me on Twitter. I'm at MEPAYNL. Well, that is it for us this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of Quick to Listen. Please go on Apple Podcasts and rate and review the show. You can also find it wherever you like getting your podcasts. We are there. This podcast is produced by myself and Matt Lindor. The transcript is done by Bunmi Ashola. The music is by Sweeps. If you would like to support our publication, please do so by becoming a subscriber. You can do so by going to orderct.com/podcast. That's orderct.com/podcast. We will see you all next time.